Congresswoman Giffords is from the Tucson, Arizona, and she's one of my favorite people. She has on her portfolio DOD, science, and solar. And she has been the leader in the state of Arizona for solar. Congresswoman, great to have you here.
How's everyone doing?
Good. Do you guys need to do a stretch? Are you all right? We're coming down like the home stretch here. So I just want to thank Chuck for this opportunity to be here, and certainly to the National Academies and the Department of Energy for hosting this incredible conference. I have not been here all day. I know that one of my colleagues has stopped in, and we've had staff here. So trust that this information will be getting back to the Congress. I do serve on the House Science Committee, on the House Armed Services Committee as well, and I also serve on the Foreign Affairs Committee. The reason why I'm here, besides just wanting to hang out with the smart people, I mean, who doesn't want to come over and spend some time at the National Academies, is I'm incredibly passionate about solar energy, not just because Bill and I come from the state of Arizona, which obviously is a natural for us, but when I look at the real challenges this country faces in terms of our energy, in terms of what's happening with climate change. Obviously, we're working very hard on a cap and trade bill right now as it moves to the Congress. In terms of innovation and us not producing enough scientists, engineers, mathematicians, I really think that solar energy is an incredible solution to the really hard, tough issues that we face. The world faces them, but we, as a leader in technology and a global force, certainly have a lot more at stake than other countries. So that's why I'm so excited to be here. Like I said, hanging out with the smart folks, you have all of their bios. I know we have a little bit of a time period, and because the topic of our panel, the final panel, key issues and next steps forward, I know we're going to want to hear from a lot of you. So, gentlemen, if we can keep comments 5 to 7 minutes, if at all possible, we have with us today Jim Ryan from Joint School of Nanoscience and Nanoengineering, Eric Daniels with BP Solar. We have Mark Pinto, Applied Materials, and Richard Bendis with Innovation America. If we can probably just start with Jim. Like I said, 5 to 7 minutes. Keep it lively. Keep it, this is it. We're gonna bring it back home. So I'm looking forward to hearing all of your good questions. Raise your hand if you've been here the entire day, sat through. Okay, all right. So we're going to be looking for questions and good comments. So take it away.
Okay, thank you. I'm not here because of my current assignment, which is Dean of the Joint School of Nanoscience and Nanoengineering. I'm here because of my work at the College of Nanoscale Science and Engineering, and before that, at IBM. And so we heard John Kelly's presentation today, for instance, and a lot of those acronyms that he showed in his presentation, I somehow worked in, helped, mentored, whatever, and so I have an interest in forming these kind of industry, government, and university consortia. And there's a number of things that have come up today, and this is certainly a fascinating area, and it seems like although there are a number of consortia that apparently have been formed, there's certainly a discussion about other potential ones that might be formed to help the industry. So I'm happy to answer any questions about my past experience, either with on the IBM side or on the Albany side.
Yes, I think 5 to 7. a long day. Just to recap discussion points that we had in this journey, We have had a long history now of perfecting the product, the final module that's gone to market. There's a bit of room that we can see ahead of us in terms of extracting more cost, better performance. We're at a juncture now where we're beginning to transition from watts and measures of watts into things that relate. The markets that we're serving are a huge transition from the standard that have products that we have today. This mic is...
Barry, can you pull that mic right up to your mouth, please, and see if that helps you? Try swallowing it.
How about if I swallow it? The flexible electronics. The few points I wanted to make are around the R&D. The R&D subsidies have been fantastic in terms of bringing new people into our organization and into our industry. We've had some key patents that we've issued in the last 3 years, largely due to new thinking from new people coming to the industry, and wish to fully endorse that. Equally, we've filed for many patents, and anything that we might do to speed up and assist our friends at Patent Office to be more responsive in terms of volume would be extremely helpful. This is a fast-paced industry and is likely only to get faster, so any help that we provide the Patent Office would be wonderful. The technology, just to a few more comments about that, in this world that we're in energy, these systems that we're installing in the field are operating now at something around 300 to 1,000 volts DC for a finance life of a project, which is a minimum of 20 years in most cases. And we really need to understand how this stuff performs over time. I've spent a lot of time looking at the design models, how we calculate the cost of solar energy over those 20 years, and there's an enormous bit of work ahead of us, opportunities to really get more precise about that to make the economic better. Just a few last comments around the supply. We had a number of discussions about import barriers, perhaps. My view has been that our industry is what it is today based on a lot of foreign markets. Most manufacturers have a multinational presence in terms of where they manufacture. Were it not for that international competition, our prices today would not be where they are. And we are now, in some cases, at grid parity. So there's more that we can do, though, to continue to drive costs. If we plan that well.
So, Mark Pinto from Applied Materials. I guess, again, talked earlier this morning. So just to summarize, first is to just remember the learning curve, that we're on a learning curve. This is a technology that is continuing to get cheaper year over year. It comes from innovation. It's technology-based. It's not just all the technology and making bigger glass. There's real technology down to the fundamental level. But even having said that, the key right now, I think we all agreed this morning, or most of us, that it's still driven by initiatives that need to happen on the demand. And I think there's a lot of creative ideas. Stephen O'Rourke had, I think, some very creative and idea along those lines. We need more of that. As time goes by, some of those things can go away. The learning curve will take us where we go. On the manufacturing side as well, I think Stephen again talked about some of the disadvantages there in terms of incentives for manufacturers. We've just had an initial start at that here in Washington to try and address that, but it is a difficult challenge for our customers, which is one of the big reasons we have so many doing projects outside the U.S. On the R&D side, I think one of the keys is to have a balance, to recognize this learning curve and not to just wait for the next big thing that somehow is going to make a 5x difference. If we do that, we're not going to be part of the game here. I think it's just that's not realistic. That's not what's happened in other industries. Having said that, there is a role to invest in future research, and there's ways to do that. Semiconductor industry, as John Kelly mentioned, and some of the different ways we've invested with universities and NSF, and so forth. The key in collaboration is finding out what's pre-competitive. And I'll give you an example. It's very difficult in solar to find that, because today manufacturing and the specific technology is part of what's competitive. I think there's like 46 startups in Silicon Valley, and I think there's 38 different SIGS processes or something like that. And believe me, I know they all want equipment, and it's all. So it's hard to find, but there are areas. And I'll give you an example, one we've been working on with the SRC. One of the things all of the solar technologies need is modeling. How do you model the optics and the electronics? And okay, you can plug in whatever band structure you want for whatever element and do the model with first principles and figure out what's going on and how to design these structures. Everybody should benefit from that. Not only that, it's something the semiconductor industry has spent a good deal of money on, have good faculty around the country. We have setups to do that. I think that's something we could all stand up and do. And by the way, I think part of this is us ourselves. I think one of the things, this is a real industry. It's a technology industry, and we should be spending R&D the way a real technology industry is. Applied spends $1 billion a year in R&D, and we're spending a lot in this area. I think if you look carefully at some of the companies in the U.S., and some of them that are making quite a bit of money, you'll see that they spend 3% on R&D. That needs to change before we, first of all, there's no need to have a consortia if you're not really spending, underspending pressure. And secondly, I think, there's something we have to step up to do at some of these companies. So the last is, again, along the pre-competitive lines, where are the standards? Where are, NIST play a role? And Derek was talking about reliability things. Those are really critical. And again, those are things I think we can all agree.
Thank you. I'm not here because I'm an expert on PV, renewable energy, solar, but I'm here because I'm on Chuck's committee that is basically hosting this symposium. I've been working with Chuck for many years in D.C. on various projects. I've created a relatively new entity in called Innovation in America, because I believe in both Innovation and America, which is a national private-public partnership that's formed as an intermediary to work between the states, regions, the federal agencies, and the investors in this world who really fuel innovation. And we just released a paper yesterday, which there's a copy going to be in the back, called Creating a National Innovation Framework. Because as I listen to everything that I've heard in this symposium today, the challenges we have aren't just in solar or PV. The challenges we have are that we have developing countries who have more integrated science and technology and innovation plans than the United States does. And I live in Philadelphia. The ENIAC computer was developed at the University of Pennsylvania. Where do you think all of the computers are manufactured in the world today? They're not being manufactured in the United States. I'm hearing that solar and PV originated in the United States, but 20 years later or 25 years later, we have all of the solar and PV every place but the U.S., except we have the biggest market in the world to be able to use this technology. The paper that we're focused on talks about the need to create a long-term national integrated innovation strategy, which does not exist, because we have federal agencies which operate as silos, do not work and leverage resources with one another, and we also have another crisis in America today. The private sector has basically taken care of early stage funding for many, many, many years, for the last 20 to 30 years. Angel investing last year went down 26%. Venture capital investing this first quarter of this year is the lowest it's been in 12 and a half years. Early stage venture capital investing is down 45%, and the average investment a VC will make is $8.3 million. Most of the people who are going to be the ones that come up with innovation in solar and PV and renewable energy are going to start out as one and two and three person firms, and they don't need $8.3 million. They need a half a million to $2 million to get started. The SBIR program is one of the solutions, which is one of the best early-stage investment programs in the world. But here we have a trouble with it now, getting it reauthorized longer than a four-month period when that shouldn't even be a national debate at this time. And I know that the Academy has just completed an assessment of the SBIR program. I'm totally in agreement that we need to renew that thing for 68 years, and let's make that one of the cornerstone early-stage funding programs that the U.S. has had for over 20 years. So at the end of the day, what this paper is recommending is that the United States really needs to get its act together. It also says that we're eighth in innovation in the world right now, based on the latest Boston Consulting Group, and we have Singapore, South Korea, Iceland, Ireland, Finland, which we know how progressive some of those have been in innovation. But if we don't do something about this now, and I think we have a wonderful window of opportunity. This administration seems to embrace potentially innovation and science based on some of the stimulus appropriations, but unfortunately there haven't been much appropriated for small and early stage innovative companies. It's generally been geared to big business. So what are we going to do as a federal government to focus where innovation really originates? And we're in a recession. And in this paper, you'll see that post 90 and 91 and post 2000 and 2001, those 3 to 5 years following those two major recessionary periods in the United States, what percentage of the jobs do you think were created by companies with less than 10 employees for the next 3 to 5 years? Net new jobs, 79%. So if we want to come out of this recession that we're in right now, we need to make a greater commitment to invest in the innovation roots of America, which is really small business, which has been building this economy. And we're going to see some of the next generation solar, PV, renewable energy ideas come out of this next generation. But we need to pay attention to this generation now. So this is a totally different perspective than what you've heard all day, and I wanted to be like Norman Johnson a little bit and be a little provocative. There he is back in the back. But I think for the Congresswoman here, I think, who serves on the House Science Committee, Chuck Wessner and Jim Turner helped prepare this paper with the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, with the National Association of Seed and Venture Funds, so it's not just done in an isolated fashion. We believe we have an opportunity to mobilize Innovation America now and regain our leadership position in the future.
Excellent. Let's open it up to the floor for questions, comments. I know, you know, it's getting late, but here's really an opportunity to figure out as an organization and how, you know, I don't know how much networking was done earlier on. We can really figure out with the PV manufacturing portion, which does tie into many of the points Richard brought up, how do we move this forward? I know a lot of points were made earlier about just domestic demand. Certainly from a legislative standpoint, we have been pretty aggressive in the Congress to try to put renewable energy on the map. We have a long ways to go, but in terms of the renewable energy standards that are now going through states and this is weaving its way to the Congress, you know, we're really trying to put a message out there to industry that that now is the time to step up and make the investment. So, and if people that come could introduce yourself and also, you know, which organization is helpful as well.
Okay, I'm Frank Calzanetti, University of Toledo. Thank you. We heard a lot today about forecasts and projections for 2025, 2050, but I want to ask a question about two-year, four-year, and six-year time horizons and planning horizons. And what I mean by that is the politics, of course. I spent some of my years in Oklahoma and a long time in West Virginia, so I'm a little bit familiar with the oil and gas industry and the coal industry. And the comment was made, this is a real industry. And often to get things done, you really have to, in Washington or in the state capitals, you really have to have strong support of industry. I remember when Terrence O'Donnell and Norm Johnson were trying to get our renewable energy portfolio standard pushed through the state of Ohio. Without the university coming forward and the R&D community coming forward didn't do it. It wasn't until industry stepped forward that they really took notice and looked at this as a job creation activity. But even in Ohio, the coal industry is very strong, and so it was a real push to get this through, and it opened up a lot of opportunities for the coal industry. The question of scale of these investments was raised when Congresswoman Kaptur was here. And with respect to the coal industry, again, I think the Future Gen project, was that $2 billion for a 250-megawatt plant? I think it was. It seems to me that's a lot of money, but it was seemed to be okay. You know, that's okay to spend that much money on coal. And the question is, you know, why can't we do this in solar? Why can't we step up? And whether or not the industry itself is mobilized enough to make things, shake things up in not only in Washington, but our state capitals. Thank you.
I'm not sure I remember the whole question. But when you look, for instance, at potential investments, not only do you have federal investments, there are also state investments. Universities are investing in the sense that they're building buildings and helping to create jobs. A lot of universities really have that as part of their mission in terms of economic outreach. So, you know, in the near term, I think everybody's working on it, but certainly financially, everyone is a bit constrained. Hopefully, over that horizon that you talked about, I think that there'll be more.
And let me just jump in there. I, in some ways, I think about the economic impact of fuel prices going up last summer. And when you looked at people going out and buying cars that were more fuel efficient, investment in solar, right before the financial meltdown. But it's one of the, you know, the economics of the situation is really a main driver for people and community when they determine whether or not heavily invest or not. So, I mean, our challenge, you know, I find on, you know, you talk about investments at from a federal level, a state level, large companies, small companies. A lot of it's obviously driven by the individual consumer. And part of what we find in our office is just basic education. People are curious, but they don't understand how solar works. They don't understand how their tax credits actually play in. They don't understand how long they last. So we have these things in our office. It's just solar power 101, where we do it in conjunction with the Pima County Library. It's a two-hour. We do it. I mean, the interest is tremendous. I mean, we do it. The first hour is a new presentation on some aspect of solar. The second hour is just the basic PowerPoint presentation on how does it work and how do I install it and how do I know whether or not it's a credible company that I'm working with. And the more that we can just get that message out to the consumer who also has a small business or works in a large business, I mean, it really helps in terms of the education effort. But that's going to take all of us in this room, in our respective communities, to take the time and the effort to put the education programs in place, because it is hard, unless you know, with the price of energy as it currently is, it is hard to get people excited about making the investment at this point.
I want to hear more about consortia, and it seems like you guys are exactly the right people to ask. I think the questions in my head about where the PV industry could go with organizing into consortia for some sort of collaborative benefit to everyone. What is something that you could see happening? I mean, is it by technology? Is it the thin film amorphous silicon people get together and then the crystalline silicon people get together and find collaborative activities that they could do? Is there actually anything to do? Is there pre-competitive research other than the modeling that you guys came up with that you mentioned, Mark Pinto? Is there actually something here that you could collaborate on in this field?
So I think.
Oh, and by the way, Marie Mapes from Dewey.
So I think I know the answer is yes. It's not as simple though. You know, it's again, you know, in the semiconductor business, we have the CMOS, CMOS roadmap. There are some choices at some point that you have to make, but that we target an oxide thickness and a gate length, and it's the same structure. A lot of the reason that works is because each company differentiates downstream. Intel has its microprocessor architecture, and Qualcomm has its radios and so forth, and they can differentiate and they can use the same, share a lot of the same information. So it's not quite as easy because there isn't the equivalent of CMOS that everybody uses. And if you're using a multi-crystalline technology that looks the same, you know, Eric's has a higher efficiency, right? And he gets higher yield. Certain aspects of that, is very, very competitive. Having said that, though, there are things. I said modeling and simulation. There are some things further downstream in terms of back end that could be viewed that way. In terms of certainly things like reliability and characterization. To have higher quality, higher confidence that these modules are going to last. I mean, you look at all of us. What would be a terrible thing to happen, no matter what BP's quality is, if some companies from China, no-name companies, install solar panels in Arizona, some of her constituents, they fail on their roof, it's not good for the whole industry. And that's something we should work together to do. We should work together to figure out ways to measure the panels in a short term to guarantee they work for 30 years. How do you do that? So there are areas. It's just I don't think it's quite as straightforward because there's not this boss road. Easier thing to find. I think that would be my.
If I could offer comment, I'm Jim Rand. I'm with GE Energy, but I'm also the industrial board chairman of a consortium, an NSF consortium, on crystalline silicon. And there's 10 companies. We sponsor work at 5 universities. And it works great. It's very narrow. It's on crystalline silicon and wafers. And I think that's an active way to go. I think we're much more efficient delivering money for applied research to the universities than the government is. Very similar to the SCR, which I think is great. That being said, I don't think Semitech works in our industry.
Now, are you saying SRC?
Mm-hmm. SRC.
Okay.
Correct.
And you're talking about SISOC.
I'm talking about SISOC. So SRC, I think, is great. Applied research, universities, I mean, the industries can help funnel that money in, but Semitech won't work. The semiconductor industry is just radically different from the solar cell industry. With the IP all comes at the device level, there's no similar analysis. Although applied materials may counter that, but I would argue that there's no similar analogy.
So I've been both a member of Semitech as a customer and as a supplier. I agree with what you're saying. I think the using Semitech is more as a model of how the companies can work together with government. I don't think the actual concept of what Semitech is necessarily, that is not a model, because it is exactly as you said. There isn't, manufacturing is a competence that people differentiate with. We can't find that big a common denominator. Something like that work. Now, having said that, you know, there still could be other grand challenges out there that maybe companies would want to get together. Don't necessarily. It's not something that's a phase where you need universities, and it's more the government and companies, and it just shows it can be done. But you're right. I don't believe Semitech point. You know, as the exactly analogous at all.
We're a believer in consortia for a variety of reasons, but they all take a very strong approach to solve a problem. One example, having a discussion with Mark about changing the fundamental processes of cell manufacturing, a very specific problem that we have where we need some new tools to bring to bear. We have commonly, though, structured the teams around the full channel to market, the full supply chain, in order to make sure that the investments in technology upstream always have a commercial outlet. So often we'll bring in a commercial part of these, and we found a great part. Walmart, example,
They've allowed us to test a lot of interesting things on our rooftop. The other examples, just to think outside the box a little bit, our industry has been through quite an evolution over the years, and the use of this technology is only limited by our creativity. Norway was the first market. They still use solar today on cabins. They gave birth to a DC cabin market that still thrives today, powering homes off-grid. In the United States, we worked with a consortium to develop solar-powered obstacle beacons and traffic boards. That entire industry in the space of 3 years went from fossil fuels to solar. So there are other ways to structure research usually in development that lies probably below the these kinds of discussions that I want.
Yes, sir.
Name
and background?
Yeah, Roger Little from Spire Corporation, and I made a comment this morning, and I had a question for you. Namely, I'm concerned that, first of all, I'm happy to think that the market in the U.S. is going to grow rapidly as a result of the stimulus bill, investment tax credits, and other initiatives at the state level, in Arizona, for instance. I'm concerned that there's not enough manufacturing in the U.S. to fill that market. There's a tremendous shortfall. And therefore, I'm concerned that the market will be satisfied by imports from other countries. So what I would like to see, and you're in a position maybe to take action on it, is more Buy American permeating the whole stimulus bill in the investment tax credits. Currently, if the federal government buys something, there's a Buy American requirement, which is more than 50% of the content be done in America. If you go to DOE and you get an R&D contract, even if you do a 50% cost share, you've got to do 50% of the R&D in America. So why can't we require those situations where you give a 30% grant for a system to contain 50% American content, or a 30% tax credit for increasing manufacturing, 50% American content?
You know, the Buy American provision, I don't think you're going to find a member of Congress who is an incredibly patriotic. I mean, you know, it's just the nature of the business when you run for political office. But it gets to be really tricky looking at the international. I mean, obviously, we have trade relationships with all these different countries. When you look at from equipment to products, I mean, from, you know, being able to put together materials, I mean, a lot of those come from different countries, from, for example, you know, the mining capabilities that we have in this country. So it's very tough. And once we start, you know, closing off our you know, putting in trade barriers or closing off, and you know, what the opportunities are for other countries, then they end up shutting the door on us as well. I mean, I'm just a big believer in the American people and American ingenuity. And I think if we really challenge the American people, and I get back to what I was talking about last year, where Americans sort of woke up and realized, hey, we're losing this battle, you know, that the country will really sort of go back and refocus on this. We have a lot of work to do when we look at the business environment for small businesses and large business to be competitive. I mean, I think, look, instead of just Buy American, it's really looking at how we structure some of these trade deals and making sure that we don't put ourselves at a specific disadvantage. But, you know, increasing domestic demand will be the best thing for domestic manufacturing, in my opinion. You know, if we can really get small businesses, large businesses to be, you know, to be doing the installations and doing the investment, that's going to be the thing that's going to spur ingenuity and it's going to spur a lot of these small companies. But I'm certainly, you know, I looked at Bill. I mean, you know, Bill Harris, if you haven't had a chance to get to know him, is a tremendous resource, not just for the state of Arizona, but the country. So, Bill, I'm just, you know, jump in. If you have, you know, we've been fighting this battle for a long time in our home state. Is there anything you'd like to add to this?
I mean, the Buy American thing is something that we would all probably feel good about, but I think that what the Congresswoman has said is right. It's a global market. And maybe what you want to do is encourage the countries that sell things here have open markets as well, And we've heard today a number of countries don't allow cars into their country. We have their cars here. There's got to be that kind of political give and take. But there's also got to be a growth in the manufacturing here if we're going to be successful.
Yeah, I won't push this too hard any further, but I was specifically saying when federal dollars are involved, not generally fences for foreign goods, but if the federal dollars are going into a project, there should be some Buy American, there should be some Made in America requirement. Thank you.
Follow on that point again, it's a good point. How do we handle DOD things? That may be a model to think about. We have historically said we don't have an industrial policy in this country, but yet we really do. It's called the Department of Defense. It's been a hugely successful enterprise, and we've perhaps abandoned some of our other industries that I think you're referring to.
Bill, it's the largest energy purchasing entity in the United States of America, and the only one allowed by federal policy currently to enter into long-term power purchase agreements. So, Congresswoman, that's part of the mix of things to consider.
Congresswoman, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Doug Payne. I'm co-founder and executive director of SolarTech. We're a California-based industry consortium, and I've spent the better part of the past several years on roofs in California trying to manage this growth, so I thank you for the opportunity. We heard a lot today about Semitech. I spent the better part of a decade introducing new products in that environment, so I'm very familiar with the innovation, manufacturing, time to market. What I like to do is tie the downstream issues to execution to the manufacturing competitiveness and cycle time and innovation piece. And I'll give you three data points, and I'd like to play this back to the panel and get your reaction. In downstream, I represent over 60 member companies and our board of directors, Applied Materials and SunPower and others. So we're on the roofs. We're looking at standards and best practices for the industry in a number of areas. Three different data points. Number one would be, for the average residential home, the time we would spend on your roof is 3 to 5 days. Behind the scenes, behind the curtain, it's over 100 to 120 days. We have to do better. Another data point, of that 100 to 125 days, 35% of that is institutional barriers, utilities, cities, jurisdictions. Those are things that the market won't find that sweet spot with price points. The other point, when we talk about risk of investment and risk to innovation and manufacturing, about 15 to 20% of the profitability is in soft costs, human costs, the hidden costs behind that cost per watt reduction roadmap. So with billions of dollars in stimulus invested in technology, innovation, and products, and I'm a huge proponent of that because I did it for a decade, we want to need to, and I think we need to look downstream, is when do these things come to market? And if the incremental funds are not set aside to remove these downstream barriers to adoption, permitting, jurisdictions, codes, standards, financing best practices, these will be a fundamental barrier to the investment up front now today that will not translate to the real rooftops and jobs. Last little data point, commercial solar markets, about 90% of it involves financing. One transaction is over 200 pages of paper. So these are the things strategically to take a very small incremental percentage of the dramatic investment, move it alongside, invest strategically to meet everything else in the middle, and move things seamlessly 2-3 years from now. Welcome your thoughts.
Panel.
Yeah, a couple of points. I can buy a home today and find a place to plug in my washer, dryer, and refrigerator. I can't buy one to plug in my solar array. There's a fair amount of standards. The NAHB was on many years to address that, perhaps a bit ahead of the time. The simple thing, the challenges that you talked about in terms of installation time, so much that's something where perhaps authority might help. But to one of the points that was raised earlier, big issues we found, as I mentioned, the systems are working really high voltage, more practical problem. At that high voltage over the time of the systems being in the field, we have a large challenge ahead of us in terms of the reliability of the electrical circuits. And the last thing we need, of course, are blemishes in the growth of our industry. Standards for the DC circuits are weak compared to AC circuits in homes. It's an enormous opportunity to really improve the reliability and longevity of the product at the system level through those kinds of standards. I'm a big supporter of thereafter.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you. And we're going to cut the line up, Jim, because I know we're told about 5-10 more minutes. So, yes, ma'am.
I'll be quick. I'm Santosh Krenek from Rochester Institute of Technology, Microelectronic Engineering. Over the last 27 years, we have sent about 1,000 engineers to U.S. semiconductor industry. And now with the convergence of semiconductor with photovoltaics, there's a big demand for education. So my question relates to education. First of all, most of the photovoltaic research is confined to science laboratories, and engineering has to come up to the plate. There is no professional journal on photovoltaics from engineering community, and IEEE recently decided to start a transaction on photovoltaics. I hope they do, and I would like to see IEEE being represented, and then we could address problems related to the circuits that will go with the DC power output. And my other question is that most of the research in photovoltaics, when we are funding at the graduate level, we get students from overseas. And nowadays, a good number of students, international students, are returning to their home countries and taking back the knowledge as well as federally funded research knowledge that they acquired to their home countries. And we have to groom domestic students to join the graduate workforce. So what can you do so that our domestic students can take on graduate studies in energy? Because students in other countries, they have subsidized undergraduate education. Students in China and India, they hardly pay any tuition for their undergrad education, whereas in US, when students graduate from their BS degrees, they have loans to pay, and they cannot immediately join graduate workforce. So something has to be done to address that.
I could make a comment. I think that although certainly there are things we could do in public policy, in terms of people going into engineering and science, I think the problem starts in our K through 12. And it's not cool to be an engineer. It's not cool to be a scientist. And I think somehow we have to change that perception. And K through 12, we have to get people who can teach science and actually know what engineering is. Some will know what chemistry is, but they really don't know what engineers do. And so it really does help when the universities with programs have that kind of outreach. We were talking about it at lunch today, that what we do need is specific education programs in energy. We didn't have them in nano, for instance, and I'm, it's a little bit near and dear to my heart. And so now there are educational programs in nano that are springing up across the country, and I think I see energy as being the next thing. But a natural trajectory is to begin at the graduate level and then try to encourage as many American students as possible to take advantage of what will be good assistantships in those programs.
Thank you. And I'm going to touch, too, because it's something that, from a policy standpoint, we work on so much. Your two questions really dovetail. How this country got to be the great country it is today, technological standpoint, obviously had to do with fear. This braced with the Russians when they launched Sputnik over 50 years ago, and us committing an education system to scientists and engineering. Kids, you can't scare them these days. It's really hard. You try to put the fear of God into them, and it doesn't work. I think we were just a different world back 50 years ago. We were more vulnerable. We probably were more innocent to a certain degree. After World War II, this country, I think, had an opportunity for leadership, and certainly President Kennedy really sparked something in the American people. I'm very optimistic because I think President Obama has been able to tap into that. We just passed a piece of legislation signed into law that dramatically affects volunteerism, because what we're seeing with kids is that for example, the North Koreans have the ability to launch a two-stage rocket, or the fact that Iranians may be developing nuclear technology, or all these things that 50 years ago really would have, I think, inspired kids to get more involved, or certainly parents at least be pushing their kids, that's not an incentive for kids. What they do care about is what's happening to the planet, and they do care about climate change, and that's where I think this opportunity for this new Apollo mission, and that's why I I think that, you know, what we've been doing in the Congress with the tax credits and the incentives are for renewable energy in general. Those of us who really care about solar and think that, okay, solar is a little is more of an infancy stage than maybe wind or other renewables out there, or specifically wind, obviously it's most advanced, but we think that that this opportunity is something that will, you know, be that impetus. So I just wanted to touch on that because I from an educational standpoint, there are opportunities with pieces of legislation that are moving forward, educational programs, but also there are these little solar institutes that are sprouting up around the country, and there hasn't really been a connection between all of them. I know, like in Arizona, our three major universities all have solar institutes in the last 2 years. So there are opportunities there, but I want to make sure that we're not trying to incentivize the kids with something that's not going to work with them, because, you know, telling them that the Chinese are putting on more solar panels than we are, that's not something that's going to inspire them just from a competitive standpoint. So, Jim, you're going to close us out.
Great. Jim Hurd, Green Science Exchange. Want to address this to the panelists and to the Congresswoman. We've had a focus so far this year in stimulus, you know, shovel-ready job approach. We know we're going to get to the research side of things, but what really I haven't heard much talked about is the innovation and the monetization of innovation, of the things we can do that are big home runs in the next 2 to 6 years. And everybody seems, in my opinion, to avoid this conversation, and partly because nobody wants to use the word valley of death anymore. You know, Dr. Westner has fought the good fight. ATP has fought the good fight. I think we have to hit the ball out of the park and realize that we have to raise this game much, much higher, as Tom Friedman has said, in, hot, flat, and crowded. If we don't lead and monetize in ET like we led and monetized in IT. So I wanted to ask you all, what are your feelings about, you know, getting to this area where we will probably have to pick some winners? We don't need to worry about maybe Europe, where sometimes they move slowly in terms of startups and then they do spin-outs out of corporations. But in Asia, they can wake up in the morning and tomorrow give $50 million and 5,000 people to a startup and say, go lead. So I'd just like to say, in a quick-moving world, how can we, you know, take these, like cellulosic ethanol, I think is a prime example, and how can we, you know, encourage these, and we probably will have to pick some winners, and it'll be a messy process. So I just wanted to throw that out and say, how do you all see dealing with this issue, which I don't hear almost anybody talking much in, you know, in Washington these days? Thanks.
I guess I would have a different view. I think there is an issue in kind of small to medium scale, but I really do on a big scale. I think there are ways to finance that if you have ideas and there's market pull, and you are picking winners like a $500 million loan guarantee. I think is crazy. Picking a just unbelievable that you pick one technology 40 flavors of that technology.
You can foster innovation without sure. picking winners.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's more of that that needs to be done, but pick, you know, big amounts for one slice, that's really hard to understand. I think that's the fear most people have, and I think it was realized.
But we have great innovation, and we're afraid to get behind it and lead China with it because
Well, I think we're talking about a portfolio approach. And you really look at the portfolio, I think we actually have some gaps in federal funding that exist today. And they probably are at the and that basically at the early side, and then we're talking down at the more mature side. And it's the funnel approach. It's sort of the VC model. And when you say picking winners and losers, I think the federal government now today has to be more of a catalyst to stimulate more innovation, because it's not going to happen as much in the states and from the venture capitalists we need to get more of this innovation into the portfolio so that we have the opportunity to pick winners and losers. We might lose a generation of innovators if we don't do something on the edges like we're talking about right now. And I think that it's more of a crisis than people were talking about. I know that we've got a lot of big businesses sitting at the table up here. But guess what? They started very small a long time ago. And it took many years to get to where you are today. And it all happened through an innovative process. They actually survived because they were the winners, right? Okay, so at the end of the day, though, I think we're going to lose a lot of high-quality jobs. We're not going to take all of this knowledge that's built up in the United States for many, many, many years unless we come up with a plan to stimulate this innovation immediately. We can't wait. We're losing ground every day. And these innovators will go someplace else where they'll find somebody welcoming with money in other countries to commercialize their technologies if we don't find ways to do that and provide a catalytic stimulus is a good word, through federal government funding today.
I don't disagree with you, but just to take one counterposition on VCs, take thin film. Every VC had to have a thin film PV company in their portfolio. Funded way too many of them.
You're right.
And they threw way too much money. So is it a bad thing to spend it that much? Probably not.
No.
Probably spending four times what you prove one was going to work. So some of it is of our own doing.
Like sure it is.
Mentality towards, you know, doing all the same things. And that's where the gap comes in, because then you're funding all the same
things. Well, and that's the other thing, is everybody has to have one of something. And Congresswoman talked about three solar departments in three universities in Arizona. The key is, what would have happened if those three universities got together to develop one world-class solar institute in Arizona? And this isn't to say that you don't have three that are good, but why not leverage resources, eliminate that 45% overhead that you're going to have at each of the institutions, be able to get more of the money into the research that can go towards commercialization? Right.
That's why it's important for the government.
Final comment, Eric. We're getting the hook. Chuck's like, okay, wrap it up, folks.
A quick comment on the bigger question. As I travel around, and it sort of picks up on the theme earlier about what people today are asking about in terms of how they can participate in clean tech, low carbon, like, and what I'm sensing is I think ultimately the supply decisions in terms of the energy grid, which technology wins, will be borne out by the market. There's too much investment in one, it'll take care of it. But what will help spur a lot of the demand side is taking the smart grid one step further and building around it a relationship with your supply that is more than what smart grid offers now, where you have a utility having controlled appliances in your house or, you know, better of the network to where users can actually understand exactly how they can participate.
I want to thank the panel. I obviously want to thank the National Academies, the Department of Energy. Just a couple parting words. One is be bold. I mean, now is not the time to sit back and not go out on a limb and take risks. And the second is, you know, when you talk about working with consumers, when there's a lot of competing messages out there, we have to make this technology approachable, we have to make it easy to understand, and we have to get people excited about it. Because in my opinion, there's nothing really more exciting than seeing your meter go the other way. You know, we all like to, you know, particularly now in this economic downturn, you know, we want to save our pennies, and, you know, what a great way. I mean, I'm a huge believer in solar energy, and I'm just so glad to have this opportunity with so many great people in the room to sit around and, you know, to be continued. So again, thanks so much.